For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You are listening to Over and Back's Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s. Today's mystery is, how did Dr. J go from being cool to square? Before we get to the show, I want to tell you guys about Fast Break Breakfast. It's a fellow Harvard Proxism Network podcast. If you watch League Pass every night but aren't listening to Fast Break Breakfast, you are missing out. It's what happens when you get two musicians and a comic who are overeducated, underemployed, but share an obsession about the NBA, 90s movies, and conspiracy theories. So make sure you subscribe to Fast Break Breakfast, a podcast for serious NBA fans that is incredibly not serious. Welcome back to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason, and with me again is the great Curtis Harris of ProHoopsHistory.com. Curtis, welcome back to the show.
Always good to be back.
And we are going to talk about the one and only Julius Irving and his evolution and the team's evolution from being this incredibly cruel, trend-setting, awesome dunk, this legend of the ABA that's obscured because they're not on television, but this guy who's, you know, still being told mostly through word of mouth to becoming the NBA establishment by the early 80s and reaching a great team success with his teams but somewhat doing it on a blend of his own terms and also with what, you know, the sort of this merging of the ABA's ideals but with the NBA establishment as well.
Yeah, I guess we could say Dr. J, as we talk about him, he could be seen as like the good guy. I can't remember what the right literary term, but it's going to be like the allegory, the metaphor, whatever, of the NBA's like consumption of the ABA and, you know, commodifying it, turning it completely for its own uses. So, you know, the renegade ABA becomes, you know, the business model of the conservative NBA by the end of the 80s. So Dr. J is the vehicle to tell that story, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. There's a quote from Mark Jacobson wrote a piece in Esquire in February of 85, and there's a quote from Dr. J just talking about like how he's had an effect on the game, and it's part of a longer piece of just, you know, the things that he has done to affect the style of the game. But the most important thing he said was to make this kind of basketball a winning kind of basketball, taking into account a degree of showmanship that gets people excited. My overall goal is to give people the feeling that they are being entertained by an artist and to win. Then he laughs and says, you know, the playground game, refined. Which I think is a sort of a good way of defining kind of where he helped develop the game, first through his years in the ABA, and then of course later on in the NBA. So, I think the things that made him this 70s icon of cool, of this, first and foremost, his, you know, incredible trend-setting dunks, the ones that have been seen, but the many more that have been told through legend that, you know, are unseen because they were unrecorded. Only people there, can say exactly what he does. But all these descriptions of these incredible, fabulous moves, whether they're dunks or whether they're, you know, these twisting layups around backboards or around, you know, three players, that kind of thing. And just the obscurity of his legend in the ABA in general, just, you know, it adds to it. I mean, he has this great image. He's this handsome guy. He, you know, has the wonderful looking afro and, you know, the wonderful 70s clothes. But, you know, even more so are just the, you know, what we don't see is almost better than what we do see.
Yeah, I mean, you look at, I mean, taking it way back to the beginning, like, you know, the, it's just like this legend of Dr. J. Like, who is this Julius Erving? Like, when he went to UMass, people basically just got him up there like, who's this Julius Erving? They're like, oh my God, this guy can really play. And then when he goes to the Virginia Squires, the coaches there are like, hey, he can't be as good as people said he was. They're like, oh my God, he's better than they said he was. Like, you just when you look at his stats, like when I bring up his stats on, you know, Twitter or whatever, mentioning it, it's like, y'all realize Dr. J averaged like 27 and 16 his rookie year at ABA. And it's just like, there's hardly any video of him with the Virginia Squires his rookie year. So, like, you just have to imagine, like, what is it like for this, like, scrawny small forward who could jump out the gym to get 27 points and 16 rebounds a game? And then as time goes on, we start to get more film of him, and then we get acclimated, we see the great moves, but then as you've said it so well, it's essentially like, you know, the man, the myth, or, you know, the myth, the legend slowly becomes the man. And like by the end of it, we know exactly what he is and we've seen it all and it's every little bit of it is recorded. So I think it's kind of fitting that he began in this era where hardly any games were recorded. Then by the end of it, it's all recorded for all intents and purposes. We see every single one of his moves. But as good as they were, like 1984 and 1986, is the stuff like 72 and 76 that really get people's imagination, because we don't know exactly what was going on there because we don't have the film to see exactly what kind of moves he was pulling off every night.
Yeah, and there's a couple of great photos of him that sort of tell the tale. And there's one of him at his first Philadelphia 76ers press conference, and he still has the afro. He has this like he has this gray jacket on underneath it, and then he has this big collared like patterned shirt with all this like brown and orange and gray, and is just, you know, it's just totally looking like he's still like a young man. Another one that's a, you know, publicity photo with him and Michael Jordan, and he's wearing this he's wearing sort of this like tan sport coat, very very 80s, this skinny brown tie. And he has one finger on the basketball, and Jordan has his other finger on the – Michael Jordan is in the photo, and he has his other finger on the basketball. And it's just a very – like, this, it's very much your dad, you know, in the second photo. You know, he definitely became your dad by the – you know, by the mid-'80s, which, you know, that was his age. So that's perfectly understandable, but – It's very funny to, you know, obviously we all get older, we all change, you know, it is very, these two images are a very stark contrast.
It very much is. It is like in the ABA, like, you know, the photos we do have in the ABA, we've seen it, you know, he has the big giant blowout afro, and then even by 78, his like second year in the NBA, the afro's already starting to get cut down. You're just like, oh man. And then by 81 and 82 is not even an afro anymore. He just has like, his hair is just not buzz cut anymore. It's just like he has a nice little head of hair. And then by 86 and 87, you start to see the salt and pepper look starting to come in. It's just like, oh man, Dr. J's turned into our dad. It's just, he was still getting up and making these dunks, but it's like, he just looks like a dad off the court. And like the 80s didn't help. They had like those big giant telescope glasses. So
yeah,
it's like, Doc. Yeah. Like, he went from like the fur coats in 75, like the big giant glasses in 86. It was just like, man.
Yeah. I feel like he was wearing those sweaters too. You know, he's wearing those 80s, those sweaters.
Yeah, the Cosby sweaters. Yeah.
Didn't we decide to call them Bill Russell sweaters?
Oh, you did? I'm sorry. Yeah.
I thought you did actually, but.
I don't know, but whoever said that we shouldn't call it Cosby sweaters anymore, he wore conservative 80s sweaters.
Yes, exactly. So colorful conservative 80s sweaters. So. And, you know, this, you know, we're all multifaceted, but, you know, his personality also was, you know, he talked about in his autobiography, just loving structure and order. He needed things to be neat. He was not really a guy who was involved in, you know, politics or the, you know, the Black Power movement in the 70s. He was more of a guy who just wanted, you know, just to accommodate people and, you know, be on his team. I mean, he was a, you know, he did believe in those in ideals, but he wasn't necessarily a guy who did much participating in it. He was also very much, you know, very team oriented, went out of his way to blend in with the team and listen to his coach, even sometimes to the possible detriment of his team. Also very serious off the court, not into drugs and partying, and focused a lot, especially in the 80s, on making money, establishing his businesses, what we would call today his brand. And you know, once the ABA merged with the NBA, he obviously became part of that establishment. And, you know, through the 70s and into the 80s, his look became more part of the establishment, although you can certainly argue the establishment came closer to him. And, you know, looking at what the NBA was in 77 versus 84, contrasting the 76 dunk contest, which is kind of the last great famous moment of the ABA, and then he's in the finals, keying a 20-point comeback in Game 6 of the finals to lead his team, the Nets, beating the Rockets in that, or the Nuggets in that finals. Contrasting the 76, his final moments there, the dunk contest, with the 84 dunk contest, it's very much an NBA event and very much what was going on in the NBA at the time, but it's still the NBA co-opting the spirit of the ABA for that dunk contest, and Dr. J reprising his famous free throw line dunk and doing a pretty good job of pulling off that dunk eight years later, even though he's in his early 30s at that point.
No, he did do the dunk. It was legit.
And it still looked graceful and still looked, like an incredible thing to see even today. You know, it's even empowering even today, even with all the dunks that we've seen and all, the increased athleticism in the league and, 30 plus years since this. It's still a great thing to see.
Yeah, I mean, he was 33 years old, dunking from the free throw line.
Yeah.
So definitely nothing to sneeze at. But I think you were hitting a lot of nails on the head there, like the NBA co-opting a lot of the ABA spirit. So, going back to the late 60s, early 70s, the NBA was just like, oh, the NBA is a gimmick. They got that red, white, and blue ball, the 3-point line. They don't play any defense and yada, yada, yada. And now they're undermining the whole financial structure of pro basketball, just like giving high schoolers and, 1-year college players contracts. And then, by the mid 80s, the NBA is copying all of it. They got the 3-point line in the NBA, 3-point contest, the dunk contest. So I think it's a great story showing of how, you can fear or, denigrate these new ideas or these, just new ideas. But then you soon start trying to figure out, well, if people do like the idea, how can we actually take advantage of it? Kind of harness it. I think that's a good phrase to use. How do we harness what this new thing is? Because we're a little afraid of it, but people are intrigued by it. So we got to harness it and use it for our own purposes. And Dr. J, as we talked about, he's still, dunking from the free throw line in his 30s, but you could see his style of play, had moved, I guess, the NBA center a little bit more towards his style of play, but you could also see how definitely his style of play was harnessed by the NBA toward, I guess you could say, a higher purpose from their regard, of expanding the game's reach and making it more commercial and more popular with the fans. And Dr. J was a good vehicle for that, too, because as you were saying, he was a guy that, deferred to the coach, accommodated teammates, didn't dabble into cocaine and all that stuff. That was really giving the NBA an image problem back then. Whereas a guy like David Thompson, who was every bit as exciting as Julius Erving, he did succumb to the cocaine problems like many other players did. So Julius was a success story in that regard. And that's why I think he stands out as the premier ABA player. Was the fact that, he did survive and have a lengthy career in the NBA and, didn't push back too hard against being co-opted by the NBA, I would say, in some regards.
Yeah, and he definitely straddled those two worlds of this being this great artist and being this, incredible transcendent force while also being this being the businessman and being the guy who just who went along and kind of went with the trends of the league and made his way in that world and made his way with a new team in a new league and played the game, so to speak.
Yeah, and something else that I just remember, it's like I watched the old interview of Dr. J, and this is from 1974 or 1975. And he was talking about one of his, I think it was his high school coach at the time. And his high school coach was, Julius in 75 was recalling his high school coach. So I guess it's in the late 60s. telling him, you know, like, Julius, if you want to, like, what do you want in your life? And Julius was like, you know, I want to be successful. And the coach said, well, if you want to be successful, you got to, this is America. And, like, you know, people who work hard and, like, you know, hone their talent, we have a system that allows people like that to be successful. And so even though Julius had, like, this outlandish talent that, you know, very few people have, like, this very creative talent, he still viewed that the way to make the most of that talent was to go through, like, the established, as best as he could, the established route of America, which was, you know, the old idea of, you know, working hard, making the most of your talent, you know, not obeying, but, you know, deferring to, you know, the authority in the situation, because, you know, that will eventually get you a step up. So maybe one day you become the authority, that your example is the one that people follow in the future. So, yeah, he's a curious mix of being, like, you know, a little bit of a renegade, but more so a deferential character.
Yes.
To get ahead. And that's not trying to say any of that, like, in a bad way necessarily, but it is just the way that he was. That's how he viewed it. Like, that's what he said in that interview in 75. Like, you know, this is what I was told and this is what I followed. He's like, you know, the success he had at that point, he attributed to following the kind of the guideline set out by his high school coach.
Yeah, and as much of a renegade that he was not interested in challenging authority. That was one thing he did not want to do. And he, one thing is that, you know, he was not, like, he was a very good high school player, and but he was not, you know, heavily recruited. He didn't really grow into the player that he would become until he was in college. And so he didn't have the same sort, a lot of players, you know, had been fawned over for, since they were fairly young. He didn't necessarily have that. He was a bit of a late bloomer as a player, so that probably helped him have a little bit more perspective than, you know, than other guys might have had in that situation. So he debuts with the Sixers in actually a day before he joins the team a day before the season opener. Yeah. He had a holdout with the Nets before then, trying to renegotiate his contract. The Nets, as the other ABA teams had just been had just joined the ABA, they all had to pay a significant amount of money to get into the league, and the Nets had to pay a bunch of extra money to because they were in the same territory as the Knicks.
Yeah, even though the Nets had been around since, like, you know, 68, they're like, no, you're quote-unquote a new franchise invading their territory, so you got to pay, like, a $1 million penalty.
Right. So. And they'd also acquired Tiny Archibald and, mm-hmm. you know, and paying him a significant contract as well. So they couldn't keep Irving as well, especially for the money that he was going to be due with a new contract. So ended up negotiating with the Sixers, who had his ABA rival George McGinnis there, making sure that he's okay with it. Eventually, they do make the deal, even though it hurts him to leave the Nets, who he had won two championships with in the previous three seasons. But the Sixers are a very good team at that point. They had gone from 9-73 3 years before that to a 46-win team behind McGinnis, also Doug Collins, Steve Mix, and Billy Cunningham, who was just about to retire. And so this was a team on the rise. And in 77, they were a 50-win team, which was tied for second in the league. This is the time in which a lot of parity, where the high records are not very high and the low records are not very low, and were third in the league in SRS.
Yeah, and of course, that 77 team, you know, has the famous or infamous finals against the Blazers. And we have mentioned this before about just the – all of the coded language that went into that final series. It's a doozy. But that Sixers team kind of set the template for what the late 76ers would be, where they would have this really, really good team that lost a nail biter in the playoffs. So the 77 squad, as I said, they go against the Blazers. They take a 2-0 series lead, and then they lose the next four games, even though Julius had a just absolutely fantastic, monstrous series. It is one of the overlooked NBA Finals performances. So, great individual performance on his behalf, but the rest of the team really let him down, I would say, in that series. But Julius being Julius, I don't think he would ever say publicly, like, you know, oh, the rest of the team let me down. Like, that just wouldn't be his style. But I would say the rest of the teammates did let him down, whereas the Blazers were just, you know, well-oiled machine. Everybody pulled their weight that they were supposed to pull, and they came out on top in that series.
Yeah, and Irving in that series had 30.3 points, 6.8 rebounds, 5 assists, 2.7 steals, and 1.2 blocks in, and shot 54% from the field. So excellent numbers there. McGinnis really stood out as he shot 38% from the field, 13 points, 9.3 rebounds, and was known for a high turnover player as well. The turnovers that aren't in this box score, but I would imagine that they were high.
The very next season, they finally began recording turnovers. And, yeah, McGinnis was turning them over like hotcakes.
There was sort of a mix of his adjustment to the team was a little bit tough. Gene Chu had a, you know, it was intended to be a, you know, they had a lot of guys who needed to eat, so to speak. I mean, they had a lot of gunners, you know, World Be Free, Joe Bryant, McGinnis, you know, even Collins, who was a, you know, had been a number one overall draft pick, was talented shooting guard, had a lot of foot problems. So injuries kind of kept him from reaching his potential, but a lot of guys who needed the ball. So the idea was more for him to sort of fit in rather than the team to sort of be centered around him. And they had so much talent that, you know, there was a, there was some justification for maybe thinking that way. He later referred to this as the team that won't shut up. Just a mix of interesting personalities and a lot of guys who were talented, but may have been, not necessarily out for themselves, because they did have pretty good camaraderie, but,
it was just not the work. It's like, you know, just people you get along with in terms of, like, you know, socializing, and then it's people you get along with in terms of working. And, you know, in the NBA sense, this is work for them. So, like, you know, if your personalities and demeanors don't work on the court, then, well, you're not going to be as successful as you can be. So, you know, maybe they get along. Nobody hated each other necessarily. But, you know, in terms of a basketball sense, their personalities didn't fit quite well. Neither did their games. It was an awkward pairing, and that's what happens, you know, when you just two leagues merge and players are going every which way. You're just going to get some awkward fits at that point.
Sure, sure. And, you know, one series that isn't talked about but I think is sort of interesting in a story, a narrative idea, is the East Semis. They beat the Celtics 4-3. That was the that was the year after the Celtics had won the championship. They still had JoJo White. Havlicek was, I think, 37 at that point, so he's getting near the end of his career. He'd have one more season. And they had Cowens, Charlie Scott. They'd also added Sidney Wicks, speaking of chemistry issues. But, you know, they dethroned the establishment of the old guard, the Boston Celtics, you know, the team that Red Auerbach, who hated the ABA, wanted nothing to do with the ABA, denigrated it as often as he could. They were the team that this team of playground chuckers, beat the vaunted Boston Celtics. Just sort of interesting story. I guess this gets obscured in the other, you know, Boston versus Philly legend. But I find it interesting that not really talked about in terms of this rivalry.
Yeah, but it's late 70s NBA. Nothing happened except the Bill Walton Blazers at that point. So
there you go. And they also went through Houston in that series, who had Calvin Murphy, Rutam Jonovich, a very young Moses Malone, and John Lucas, who had been a number one overall draft pick. And actually, the end of the series was a controversial charging call in Game 6. Lucas was called for an offensive foul on Doug Collins. This was in Houston, a situation where if the refs were going to lean one way, they would normally lean toward the home team, but the road team got it, and they were able to win that series. But that sort of was the end of, not the end, but a very promising Houston team ended up being scuttled the next year with the Rutam Jonovich fight, and later losing John Lucas, you know, because they acquired Rick Barry. So
not a great trade.
So moving on to 78, they're still a strong regular season team, 55 wins, second in the league in SRS. Pretty much the same team, except for Billy Cunningham becomes the coach 6 games in the season. Shu is fired, and Cunningham, you know, Shu was more of like, we need to rely on the playbook, and we need to kind of rely on our plan, where Cunningham was more of an emotional character and was more, you know, Irving said in his book that he more adjusted to the game rather than just kind of doggedly sticking toward a sort of game plan. Also, they had Chuck Daly as the assistant. Of course, we all know what, you know, what a brilliant coach Chuck Daly would end up being later on with the Pistons.
Yeah, now you kind of got it right with the description of the head of coaches. You know, Cunningham, as you said, adjusts to the game. He sees what's happening. He tries to tailor himself to the situation. Whereas Gene Shue was like, I know what we need to do. The game's not going right. We just need to try to fit the game into what we need to do. You know, trying to fit the round peg into the square hole. And the team did get off to a really bit of a rough start with Gene Shue. And then Cunningham comes in, and I think I've read in some places where Cunningham was kind of basically just lobbying for the job and undermining Gene Shue. So
yeah, I know Gene Shue. That
didn't play too well, looking back on it. But Cunningham did take him to higher success, like, eventually. But the first year, you really can't say it was a better success than having Gene Shue as coaches. They lost a round earlier. But still in heartbreaking fashion, as was typical in the late 70s for the 76ers.
Yeah, they after sweeping the Knicks in the semis with Bob McAdoo, Spencer Haywood, Jim McMillan as well. I know one of your favorites, Earl Monroe, kind of at the end there. Then they were upset by a 44-win Bullets team that that would later win in the finals in the Eastern Conference Finals. They had Elvin Hayes, Bob Dandridge, Kevin Greavy, Wes Unseld still with the team, although he actually missed three games of that series, presumably with injury. But yeah, they lost that final game in heartbreaking fashion, 101 to 99. Anything specific about that series that you recall that stands out?
No. Unfortunately, I've never been able to see any film of the series. Like, I would love to get my hands on it, but yeah. It's just in the scheme of things, it's like, well, here the vaunted Sixers with all that talent, and then they get upset once again, taken down by a team or by a franchise that has seemed to be more of a team, players that play better together. Like, Unseld missed half that series, but, you know, in the wider scheme of things, you know, Unseld, Hayes, Dandridge, Greavy, you mentioned, Mitch Kupchak, Greg Ballard. These were guys, you know, you had a couple of star players, but you had a lot of guys that kind of fit into their roles, and they knew their roles, and they played to their roles, whereas the Sixers still had all those voices going on, so to speak. So you still had McGinnis and Dr. J with that awkward fit, where I think by this point they realized, like, yeah, this just – the two just don't work well, because not that they didn't like each other, but it's just that McGinnis for some reason had this – just weird complex, like not inferiority complex, but like an idea that if he wasn't the unqualified, like, go-to person on offense, then he had a hard time, you know, being effective on offense. And if, like, Julius Erving is there, he's clearly, like, the better all-around player by that point. McGinnis kind of just shrank in the background. He really didn't assert himself. Then, of course, that offseason comes a big trade that really rejuvenates the 76ers in the long run.
Yeah, and one thing that Irvin said about McGinnis, playing with McGinnis, is that it forced him to play away from the basket a lot more, and he wasn't able to shoot as effectively from the field because of that. And his numbers were down quite a bit in his first a decent amount in his first 3 years in the league before eventually in 80 that breaks through and then wins the MVP in 81. I mean, he was still an effective player, but wasn't quite. Yeah. It was definitely a step down from his ABA days. 79, as you mentioned, the trade. McGinnis is traded for Bobby Jones. I know one of your favorite players.
Absolutely one of my favorite players. Love Bobby Jones.
Yeah. And Jones had battled with Irving in the 76 finals. Had tried to defend Irving, although Irving was awesome in that finals. And also... Willby Free was traded to the Clippers, and Maurice Cheeks was drafted as well. And these were moves that sort of started to change the tenor of the team. They definitely dropped in the regular season this year, 47-35 in the season, tied for sixth in the league with three other teams for that record, and then ninth in the league in SRS. So down in the regular season, and had similar playoff success, but. But obviously, better times were coming with the with this new crew.
Yeah, and I think what we see here is the team transitioning from this hodgepodge. You know, let's put it this way: in '76 or for the '77 season, the team didn't foresee that the ABA was going to collapse and that the leagues were going to merge and they're going to have access to all this talent. So the team they had been building before that was kind of going toward a different destination. And then all of a sudden, Julius Erving falls in their lap before the right, like literally, like you said, the day before the 77 season starts. So, yeah, they had that success, but the team they had wasn't necessarily constructed to work together. They just kind of fell into it. Whereas with the 79 team, they finally decided, okay, Julius is going to be the man. What kind of team can we build around him that's going to maximize his talent and have the players around him be maximized? So you see them getting rid of George McGinnis, who was, you know, a more creative offensive player than Bobby Jones. But Bobby Jones, whatever shots he took, he was going to make. And he's not a guy that needed the ball in his hands to be effective on offense or to feel effective on offense. And, of course, was a much better defensive player than George McGinnis. And then, as you say, you know, drafting Maurice Cheeks. There's a point guard that's going to play dead, a hard-nosed defense, was going to be able to distribute the ball and didn't need a shot either, but could make a shot if he was given the opportunity. So this kind of gave Julius and Doug Collins, like, they were the guys that were going to score the ball on offense. Everybody else was going to kind of fill in the roles properly. Still had the knucklehead in Daryl Dawkins, but for the most part, the team is starting to feel more like Julius's team, a team that's going to flow around him better. So still had that heartbreaking loss in this playoff series against the San Antonio Spurs. The Spurs almost blew this one, too, though. They were up 3-1, and they blew it almost to the 76ers.
Yeah.
And then they did it in the next round. They blew another 3-1 series lead and actually lost it to the Bullets in the conference finals.
Right. And that is that Spurs team, you know, had Gervin, Larry Cannon, Billy Pulitz, and Mike Gale, who all had been previously been Doc's teammates.
Yes.
James Silas as well on the team. The only one of those. Those are basically, you know, five of their main players on that team all had been, you know, four of them had been teammates with him. So I thought that was interesting. They also beat the Nets in the first round, of course, Doc's former team, with Super John Williamson really being the last key net from Doc's days being on that team. So, you know, 2 years later, that team, you know, is almost completely broken up.
And just one other thing about that, you know, looking at the Spurs and the 76ers rosters, you see, like, the effect the ABA had, because, you know, the Spurs are an ABA team that had joined the NBA. And all the players you mentioned, you know, Gervin, Keenan, Silas, Gale, Paltz, those were, you know, five of the six main players of the Spurs. And they were all people that came out of the ABA. And then they had Louis Dampier on the bench too, still at that point, although Dampier was at the end of his career. But you can see at that point, like, the Spurs were the, you know, one of the premier teams in the NBA, and they were stocked with all ABA talent. So you see, like, the NBA is, you know, they've harnessed it. Like, their best teams are now teams that are stacked with the old ABA talent at this point.
So moving on to the 1980 season, the bounce back, 59 wins, third in the league. They have the fourth best SRS in the league. They bring back a lot of guys, but obviously Maurice Cheeks is coming into his own in his second season and was not afraid to throw the ball to a Doc, even at the even with Billy Cunningham told him to run a play. He would ask, you know, why are you throwing a Doc? And then Cheeks' response was just because he asked me to. So he definitely knew where his bread was buttered and really became one of the you know, better point guards of the 80s. I mean, isn't really, you know, held necessarily in that high of esteem, but really, you know, you look at his numbers in the 80s and, of course, you know, the performance of the Sixers for most of that decade, and it's really good stuff. So they added Clint Richardson to the team as well, and they traded for one. Their big acquisition probably was their midseason trade for Lionel Hollins from the Blazers after they had gone after Pete Maravich, who had been finally cut by the Jazz, but Maravich decided to go with the Celtics instead.
Yeah. Better choice to go after Lionel Hollins at that point in the players' respective careers. But not that Hollins lasted much longer either, unfortunately, because of injury. But a better fit for what they were looking for at that point. And Clint Richardson, an unheralded guy, he's a little bit like Mo Cheeks, where he's one of those players that on offense didn't need the ball in his hands but played, you know, pressure defense on the ball. And he would come up big in the 83 season when they finally won a championship. So you see them adding these little players – you know, stocking the bench with the right kind of guys, you know, quote unquote, the right kind of guys to play with Julius Erving. And yeah, as you mentioned, the team took a huge leap forward in 1980. I guess it just felt like Julius, like, you know, finally had like the right kind of team around him in the NBA finally after like 3 years of waiting. And his scoring average jumped up considerably, was named the MVP of the season, of the NBA that season. And they tore through the playoffs until they got to the finals against the Lakers. And, you know, when you go against Kareem and Magic, you're going to have some trouble. But they tore apart the Eastern Conference up until that point.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they ran through the Bullets in the first round 2-0 in the miniseries. Hayes and Unseld but were, of course, still there, but they were aging, and I think Hayes was just about out.
And Dandridge was hurt that year, too.
Okay, yeah, and so. They had lost Kupchak to the Lakers as well, so we're a thinner team. Then they beat the Hawks in the semis 4-1, who had Dan Rounfield, John Drew, Fast Eddie Johnson, not the Eddie Johnson for the Suns, but the other Eddie Johnson who got in serious legal trouble.
Yes, and, yes, the convicted Eddie Johnson.
Yes, there you go. And Ed True Rollins as well. And then they beat the Celtics, who were the other emerging team of 1980. 4-1 in surprisingly reasonably easy fashion in the Eastern Conference Finals. They had won 61 games and had the best SRS in the league. Of course, Larry Bird's rookie year, they still had Dave Cowens, who was about at the end there. Cornbread Maxwell, Tiny Archibald, who they had picked up, and Pete Maravich, who was coming off the bench. I guess, you know, from what I've read, they really relied maybe a little bit too much on Bird in that series and just didn't, you know, kind of, you know, spread things out with the system. But the Sixers obviously were a strong team as well and were able to restart a great rivalry that would last through, you know, most of the rest of the, you know, particularly the early part of the 80s.
Yeah, rivalry that really went through like 85 and 86. So it was a pretty tough one, right? Almost. The Sixers were much better than we remember. Like, if we think of the 80s as the Lakers and Celtics, but, you know, if we get the first half of the decade, the Sixers were the, when you actually look at the records and stuff, they were the, not by a lot, but they were the dominant team in the East during the first half of the 80s. But,
sure, yeah.
But anyways, that's what we're talking about, how dominant they were, so.
So the Lakers, they would lose to the Lakers. Of course, the other big story of that season, Magic Johnson as a rookie, leading the Lakers to the finals in the championship. And famously, Game 6, he would have, you know, a transcendent performance for the ages in leading them to a championship without Kareem in that game. Jamal Wilkes also scoring 37 in that game to beat the Sixers that year. So 81, they get even better. They're 62-20, tied for the best record in the league, very close to the same record as the Celtics and the Bucks that year, all powerhouses in the Eastern Conference. The Bucks had just moved to the Eastern Conference. Andrew Toney was added to the team in 81, who was kind of the other really key, you know, young addition that added to the team, kind of another, you know, great draft that, you know, Pat Williams did a really good job, the famous general manager who of, you know, building the team around Doc and, you know, keeping them a contender for, you know, the next half decade.
Yeah, and by this point, this is when Doug Collins' foot problems really, you know, caused him basically to retire. So, yeah, they got Andrew Toney at the right time, like this young shooting guard to replace Doug Collins, who unfortunately should have been, you know, just at the peak of his career. His career was actually coming to an end because of those foot problems. But the Sixers, you know, as you said, they were right there with the Celtics and Bucks. And I think the poor Milwaukee Bucks. But yeah, they couldn't catch a break in the 80s. But the playoff series, the Sixers played the Bucks first. That series went 7 games, and the Sixers won by 1 point in Game 7. And then in the conference finals, the Sixers take the Celtics to 7 games, but they lost to the Celtics by 1 point. So that just shows you how close all three of those teams were that season, where you had 2 Game 7s between them, and they're decided by 2 points total. Basically, you're flipping a coin and you have the Eastern Conference champion that season between those three teams.
Right. And the and of course, you know, one bad thing for the Sixers is that with the Celtics winning the series, blowing that 3-1 lead, they faced the Rockets in the finals, who were a much easier opponent for than the Lakers. The Lakers were a little down that year, but, you know, then the Lakers teams that the Sixers would always bump into. You know, the Celtics did benefit from some luck in a lot of weirdness in the Western Conference playoffs that season. The Celtics fans tried to tip over the bus after the Game 7 loss, which of course the Sixers players appreciated. So and Irving, you know, he in his autobiography, he said nice things about basically everyone, but the one group of people that he did not say nice things about were the Celtic fans.
Well, I mean, that's not surprising.
No.
That's, if anybody's going to get on Julius's nerves, it would be Celtics fans. So, yes. So as nice and affable a man as he is, the Celtics fans would annoy him.
Yes, yes. So 82, they are still very good. 58-24, second in the league in the record, also second in the league in SRS. Pretty similar team, pretty almost exactly the same team. They buzzed through they beat the Bucks at 4-2, a little bit of an easier time beating them, although still a tough series. And then they beat the Celtics 4-3 in the Eastern Conference Finals, almost blowing another 3-1 lead, but pulling off a victory in Game 7. And there's after their Game 6 loss, Doc called a team meeting and they try to figure out, like, okay, what's going on? What can we do? And then Clint Richardson says, it's just us. And then they start sort of chanting, it's just us, like as a mantra for the team. Like, you know, we're going to do this. It's just us. You know, we believe in everything. You know, we believe in ourselves and believing, you know, we can beat the world. And then the next day in the locker room, someone had taped up all these letters on the wall of fans who believed in the team and all these kind words of, you know, we believe in you, we think you can do it. And that inspired the win even more than the other approach had, and led to the Sixers winning a Game 7 in Boston, and actually Boston fans chanting beat LA to the Sixers in that game, which, you know, for the negatives he might have had for Boston fans, that was certainly a moment that he appreciated.
Oh yes, for that one moment they weren't assholes to him.
There you go.
they were assholes to LA. That's what that one shining moment.
Yes, yeah, indeed. So the it's interesting because the Celtics really had no reason to hate LA at that point because, you know, they had beaten LA every time they'd ever faced each other in the playoffs. So there was that animosity that would come later when the Lakers started winning. You know, theoretically should not have been there, but whatever, you know. But a similar result to the 80 finals, they would lose exactly the same number of games, 4-2. The Lakers bolstered with the addition of Bob McAdoo.
Yeah, this one was a little unfair because the Sixers, their big problem was, obviously they rectified the problem in the offseason, but the big problem was still at center, where you still had Daryl Dawkins hold down the fort at center. And Caldwell Jones by this point had usurped him in playing time, but Caldwell, great defensive center, but shouldn't have been getting, you know, 30 minutes a game. Definitely a, you know, 20, 22 minute a game backup center. So Kareem was just feasting on them. And so was Bob McAdoo, as you mentioned. He was picked up and God, I'm looking at the stats in front of me. The Lakers had 6 players averaged between 13 and 20 points a game that series. So they were just spreading the wealth and having no problem going through the Philly defense.
They definitely beat them pretty soundly inside. That was definitely the key to the series. And after the loss, Irving said that he cried in the locker room for the first time in his career. You know, saying there has to be a reason this keeps happening because obviously he's been in the league now for 6 years and it has not been able to win a championship in the NBA. And there's a lot of pressure for him. You know, there is this. They did have narratives back then, and there is definitely this belief that okay, yeah, he won those championships in the ABA, but he hasn't won a championship in the real league yet. And they're definitely, you know, conceded to, you know, being frustrated by that and feeling the pressure to, you know, bring a championship to the team. Of course, he had a lot of personal pride as well, just wanted to win a championship for himself, but that was, you know, definitely a factor in things as well.
And just to pause for this moment, you brought up a good point. Julius is very defensive of the ABA. Like, you look at his Twitter handle his Twitter description, excuse me. His Twitter description says, like, you know, he's a 4-time MVP, 3-time champion. So in his mind, he doesn't view the ABA as inferior whatsoever to the NBA. Because obviously to do so for him would be to, you know, devalue what he did as a player for like the first 6 years of his career. And he sticks up for the other guys. So he sticks up for George Gervin, for James Silas, for Ron Boone, all those other guys that don't get as much attention as they should from their ABA playing days. So for him, he's very prideful of the ABA. Even though it was like the renegade league, and we've been talking about how he himself wasn't much of a renegade, he still values the hard work that was put in by the players in the ABA. So maybe it was a different sort of league. Maybe it was a little rough and tumble. Maybe it was a renegade league. But he believes that the league, like, well, it seems to me that he believes the league was filled with guys who played hard, who worked hard, who contributed a lot, and their contribution shouldn't be diminished. So it's not the least bit surprising that, you know, that narrative would annoy him in the early 80s. We're like, yeah, he's won two titles, but they weren't real titles. They were in the ABA. When's he going to do it in the real league? And sure enough, 83, they get Moses Malone and another ABA turned NBA star, and they barnstormed the league. They tear it apart.
Yeah, absolutely. They finished 65-17. Start 50-7. They were threatening to win 70, but they sort of slowed. They took the foot off the gas pedal in the last, you know, few weeks of the season and finished 15-10. But that did not hurt them at all in the playoffs. The Moses' faux prediction, or whatever you might consider it, almost came true. They beat the Knicks in the East semifinals. Bernard King, Chuck Robinson, and Paul Westphal team. Then they beat the Bucks 4-1 in the East Conference Finals. Their only loss in that series, and then stormed through the Lakers. I do want to go back to, though, because I thought it was interesting about how Doc learned about the trades. First, it was a trade of Daryl Dawkins to the Nets, and he didn't know what the team was doing. He was in China, touring China at the time. ML Carr was there, who was a Celtics player who was, you know, basically coming off the bench, basically known for sort of waving the towel in the mid-80s. But he was a good player, you know, in his day, and had started off in the ABA. So Moses would make fun of him of, like, you know, what have they turned you into? What have the Celtics turned you into? You're this towel-waving guy, and, you know, they would kind of bust each other being, you know, old friends from the ABA. And then when the first trade went down, you know, Carr's making fun of him. It's like, oh, you know, you guys, there's no way you guys are going to win anymore. You just traded away, you're only good big man. And then later, you know, reasonably soon later, they would find out about Moses. And then he would say, you know, hey, you guys just won the title. And Moses came in, and they were able to, I think he was able to work really well, blend really well with Doc, as far as, you know, he kind of made it, you know, didn't try to like carve his own territory. I mean, he was like, they're like, you know, Doc's our leader, but he put in exactly the right kind of work that, you know, filled all the gaps that the team needed while letting, you know, Irving do his thing. You know, he's advanced in age at that point, but was still a very effective player, and they were able to, you know, blend together so well on the court and off the court as well.
Yeah, what they became with Moses was just a really fierce defensive team. I've gone back and watched those games. What strikes me is like just the defensive intensity they brought, and then how that just, it's almost like an intimidation of the opponent. Because Moses Malone wasn't a one-on-one. He wasn't a great defender, but clearly he was like a monster on the board. So he would just wear guys out on the boards, and everybody else on the court was either a good or just absolutely, like, you know, legendary all-time defender between, you know, Julius and Maurice Cheeks and Bobby Jones and Clint Richardson. So they would just intimidate and wear out the other team on the court. So I think that's what Moses was able to bring to us, just like this intimidation factor. And I don't mean that in, like, you know, the stupid macho sense, like, oh, we're going to, like, beat somebody's brains out. But just, like, you see them warming up on the other end of the court, and he's like, ah, shit, we got to play against these guys tonight. Like, they're going to run us up and down the court. Moses is going to beat us on the boards. It's just not something you really get up for. It's like facing that team. And they pulverized the Lakers in the finals, although the Lakers lost James Worthy to a leg injury. So that clearly didn't help them out. But the Sixers just beat them to shreds in the finals. They had a couple of close games, but the Sixers, I don't think it was ever in doubt that they were going to win that series. And yeah, Moses, I think, just provided the right amount of edge to that team, where he wasn't going to step on Julius's toes. They both knew that the other was a superstar, but they just realized, all right, we each got kind of our own turfs, but we know that we can work together. And, like, Moses didn't come in and say, like, this is my team now. And Julius didn't say, well, this is still my team. They realized, like, it's both of ours. The team is both of ours. Like, we need each other to make this team a success. So I think that's why they succeeded as well as they did.
Yeah, and the Sixers, they stormed back from Laker leads in games 1 and 2 and able to, you know, won both those games fairly handily. You know, in previous situations, they would have, you know, Irving talked about how they would have, you know, been felt rattled in a similar situation if they had, you know, been down to the Lakers, or a lot of times they would take big leads from the Lakers and then would whittle them away and then would lose their confidence. But this year, obviously, they had the talent to maintain that. Moses averaged 25.818 in the finals, and Irving averaged 19 points, 8.5 rebounds, 5 assists, 1.3 steals, and 2.8 blocks on 47% shooting. So excellent series from him and from Moses as well, who won the MVP of the league and of the finals. And, you know, it's of course interesting that this is two great ABA players. I mean, Irving, obviously the most famous player from the ABA, and Moses, who began his career in the ABA and became a huge star. You know, these two guys with a coach in Billy Cunningham, also a guy who had defected to the ABA. So these guys with these, you know, ABA ties, you know, coming together and winning a championship, kind of the last gasp for that, you know, ABA era generation to be a dominant force in the league before the Bird Magic era would really take hold, and it would be, you know, the league would be dominated by those guys or guys who were, yep, you know, of that age for the, you know, up until Jordan, you know, took over in the took over in the early 90s.
I mean it's passing on the guard, you know, it clearly happens all the time, you know, it's the cyclical nature of the league. But yeah, it's, you got it. It's the culmination of, like, the ABA's, I guess, infection is the word I'm thinking of. Yeah, like, the infection of the NBA by the ABA. You know, the MVP, the finals MVP, the league championship. I think Billy Cunningham was the coach of the year, too, that season. Like, all these guys with these ABA ties. That was the first year they had the Sixth Man Award, and Bobby Jones won it. He was another ABA guy that came out of there, so... this is really, like, I guess the coronation of, like, the ABA success and, like, really influencing the NBA was the 83 season with the Sixers. And on top of that, when you look at Bird and Magic and the way those teams played, the Celtics and Lakers, it was very much an ABA style because, you know, Larry Bird was this 6'8 forward, 6'8, 6'9 forward who was taking three pointers. Like, what the hell is this about? Like, that's clearly something that you could say it's like a strain of the ABA. Then Magic, this 6'9 point guard, just razzle and dazzle with the passes. Like, that's something else that's from the ABA spirit. So by that point, even the players who hadn't played in the ABA were in a way influenced by the free-willing nature of the ABA that had, like, just trickled down through all the basketball and had, if not directly influenced those players, just by the ABA existing, it had allowed that kind of play to be acceptable across the board, so to speak, in professional basketball.
Yeah. And looking at, back at that 84 dunk contest, one thing that stands out to me when, you know, he famously reprises that free throw line dunk and hits it successfully is you can really see how giddy, you know, Magic Johnson and Isaiah Thomas are watching from the baseline, you know, kind of taken back to, you know, as I'm sure, you know, they looked up to Irving, even if they weren't able to see him much, looked up to him as a player and the idea of him. And, you know, I'm certainly he was a hero. I'm sure he was a hero to them. I mean, Magic, when he was when he was drafted before his rookie season, actually came to stay with Irving, and, you know, Irving kind of showed him the ropes of the league and gave him some advice about how to handle things and such. So to see, you know, the effect that he had on those guys and that generation of players who, you know, really brought the league into, you know, the whole game into, you know, a greater amount of success and a greater amount of esteem and fame and all that good stuff, and brought the business of basketball to, you know, a whole nother level. You know, it's interesting, you know, of course, how these things, you know, stack upon one another.
Yeah, and another thing to add on to it is just, like, earlier I mentioned, like, you know, Julius is so defensive of the ABA and, like, just, you know, talks about these guys that don't get enough attention. Along those lines, you know, Moses Malone was someone who epitomized kind of I guess some of the unsung nature of the ABA, where, you know, I just mentioned also, you know, like Bird shooting threes and Magic being a 6'9 point guard was like just transmogrification of the NBA by the ABA. But then you have Moses Malone, this other guy from the ABA, who was just like just the most pale male workman like player you can imagine. This is another guy that came out of the ABA. So the ABA was able to influence the NBA in a number of ways, where he had like the greatest offensive rebounder in basketball history, came from this league that was noted for like just the freewheeling nature of its perimeter players. So just the ABA giving the NBA just all kinds of sustenance and, you know, just things to market in the '80s. The NBA just benefited so much from what the ABA provided. And this is of course 40 years after the leagues merged this year. So the influence is still there. It's still palpable in a number of ways. Cool in the Gang is a good analogy for Dr. J.
Okay.
Because Cool in the Gang was really awesome in the 70s because they did like Jungle Boogie and Hollywood Swinging. And then by like 1986, they were doing songs like Cherish. And that song sucks. So I just want to put it out there. They had some good stuff in the 80s too, but they also had some real bad crap in the 80s too. So
sure.
For those of you who are music aficionados, I think the Cool in the Gang analogy also works for Dr. J. I just thought of that.
I do feel like Dr. J in the 70s represents like 70s funk, and then in the 80s he represents more of like the
it's called urban contemporary music.
Yes, exactly.
It's like Anita Baker.
Right. Like, yeah, that very poppy, like, you know, some of that's really good, really catchy, really interesting, but it doesn't have like the same.
It ain't got the rawness.
It's very produced, you know, and then that is sort of, you know, kind of, you know, where it takes you from cool to square with Doc is where, you know, I guess as much it's as much the times changed than he changed. But, you know, it's been interesting to kind of look at that. So thanks, Curtis, for being on the show. Greatly appreciate you being here. And thanks, everyone, for checking us out. You can find us at harborparoxysm.com. You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher, wherever you listen to your podcasts. We would appreciate a rating and review. That always helps people find out about us and satisfies their egos as well, which, is important. And you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at Over and Back NBA. Let us know if you're enjoying the basketball mysteries of the 1970s. It's been a lot of work for us. We've had a lot of great guests and a lot of fun discussions. So we appreciate people letting us know if you enjoy it. And until next time, thanks for listening, and we'll talk again soon.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.